Morning. Today, Gemara Baba Vassar, we're in Daf Nun. We start today on Mem Testament Base. We're starting with the words Harayesh. If he produces proof, then he can. He can what? So he can acquire his wife's property, or he can sell his wife's property. The course of yesterday's Daf, the Gemara discussed an Ish husband trying to create a chazak on his wife's property. So we already learned back in the Mishnah that he cannot. And he can't create a chazak on his wife's property because that's what he's supposed to be. That's where he's supposed to be. He's supposed to be on his wife's property. And as a result of the fact that he's supposed to be there, so he can no longer say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, however long the marriage lasted, that I create a kinyan chazaka for being here. That's just simply not the case. The Gemara, in fact, was so bothered by this because the Gemara said it's pashut. It's obvious. It's of course not. So he's entitled to peiros, and that's by virtue of that, he's supposed to be there. So yesterday, the Gemara carved out a chiddush in the Mishnah. It's including even a case where there was an expectation that he was there, but okay, anyway, but that's the basic idea. And in the course of the discussion, the Gemara notices, you know, it's pretty clear from the entire discussion that he can't create a cheskes gimel shanim. But what if he outright bought it? Okay, it sounds like from our entire discussion that a cheskes gimel shanim that he can't create, but he could purchase it, he could buy it. So the Gemara says, now why should that be the case? So the Gemara says, okay, even a sale that he does on his wife's property shouldn't work because we never really understand that her agreement to sell is a genuine agreement. In fact, the argument can be made on her behalf, which is, look, I know you sold the property, but nachas ruach hasisi labali. I really wanted to make peace between me and you. And I know that if there was a property that you wanted to sell and I would have stopped you from selling the property, I know you'd be upset with me. So therefore, I didn't say anything. But the truth of the matter is I was not genuine in my agreement to sell. And so this is an excuse. It's a very strong excuse that a wife can make. And as a result of that, the sale should never be a validated sale. There is a comment over here made by the Rashbam that it's a little bit difficult. It's a little bit difficult to hear and understand. The question of the Rashbam is very good. The answer of the Rashbam is a little bit difficult. The Rashbam wonders, Tema nachasru chasis alabali shemachru lo. I'm sorry, shemacharti lo shelo yichos alai. I sold it to him, but I only sold it to him because I didn't want him to get angry with me. But really, the truth of the matter is that I really wasn't. I wasn't genuine in my commitment to sell. And the Rashbam over here is bothered by a really simple question. You know, the last couple of days we talked about forced sales, and we talked about the efficacy of a forced sale. It works. A forced sale works because you're going to get something in response to your sale, otherwise known as money. So if that's true, so why over here? Look, it's true that she can make an argument in terms of why she's not going to sell it, but ultimately, isn't a forced sale a sale? That's the question. It's really good. The question's excellent. And the Rashbam's answer, very interesting. So again, why is a forced sale good? So we've gone over this already a number of times. This is Rav Huna's argument. And that is that, look, he was forced, it was under duress, but he got some sort of remuneration, and eventually he acquiesced. That's the svara behind Rav Huna. Avahacha deleka unis kokach lo gamra va'akne. But over here, there's not that much pressure, and because there's not that much pressure, so therefore, lo gamra va'akne, so therefore she didn't really capitulate to the sale. It's kind of hard to understand. Meaning, if there's a lot of pressure, and we assume capitulation, so if there's less pressure, so shouldn't we for sure assume capitulation? And so the Rashbam's comment over here is a little bit difficult to understand. But okay, certainly the question needs to be asked, the question needs to be answered. I'm still struggling to understand the Rashbam, but the question is, why isn't this a case of Teluya Vazovin?
But what does she get? In the other case, the guy gets money.
I assume.
Here, what does she get?
I assume she's getting money. Or
she's getting also
If she's not getting money, so then I could see the difference.
I thought that's what he was saying.
He's not. I mean, he doesn't. He doesn't mention a word about the money. So, okay. Yeah. Mechira usually involves money. Okay. Anyway, but it's certainly worth noting. So that's the argument that she can make. We're making on her behalf. Therefore, the sale is not a valid sale. So hachinami tema nachas ruach chasisa labali. So the Gemara says, okay. So now that we have this argument in play, that a wife doesn't really ever genuinely agree to the selling of her properties. And we assume that, meaning we assume that she doesn't. And even when she says yes, her yes is not really yes, it's just simply to keep the peace in the house. So therefore, the Gemara says, why don't we say the same thing over here? So the Gemara says, okay, so now we're going to be talking about the properties that are earmarked for her. We're going to categorize them into three different compartments, into three different categories. One, a property that was actually written to the ksuva. Now let's be clear. When a man marries a woman, so in order to create financial protection for her, so the chachamim instituted the ksuva, so that upon death or divorce, so there's going to be a sum of money that's going to be paid towards her. As a means of protecting her, either upon death or divorce. And that ksiva obligation is mortgaged against his property. So in other words, truth of the matter is that all of his properties are mortgaged against that obligation. But to create more security for her, so what he does in the ksuva is he actually writes out and identifies a particular property that's going to be the first first address to turn to in the event of death or divorce. And this does not exclude the other properties, which are still all going to be mortgaged against the obligation, but he actually writes an address down on the property. And the second one is one where he designated. How is this different than the previous one? This one over here, he didn't actually write down to the ksuva, but he verbally designated at the chasna. Look, I have a property, it's over here, and we shouldn't be talking about death or divorce right now, but in the event of death or divorce, so that's the property you're going to get. So this category is really not much different than the first category, just that instead of writing it down, he verbally designated it. And finally, achash ichnisa lo shum mishalo. And third in this category is nechsetzon barzel. Nechsetzon barzel, which we've discussed time and again, is that at the time of the wedding, if her father gives a property into the marriage and says, this is for my daughter for the wedding, so what is typically done is that this property that is assessed at the time of the chasna, we have an appraisal, and the Gemara Ksuvos tells us that you're never going to find a chasna without a fight. And why is there no fights at the chasna? Because there's going to be a lot of financial haggling, including like this scenario over here, where the property is going to be assessed at the chasna. We're going to write down the appraised value at the chasna. And if you remember back in Ksuvos, we talked about how, because it's a chasna, everything is, roses. So sometimes there's a hyper evaluation of the property. Anyway, I digress right now. Let's go back. So, and this property is the value of this property is going to be put into the chasna, into the ksuva, meaning it's actually written into the ksuva. And now, who does the property belong to? The husband. Now, the husband belongs to property, but since the value was written into the ksuva upon death or divorce, the value, not the property, but the value is going to be returned back to the woman. Now, it can be returned to the woman just simply in the form of the property. But, in other words, it either inflates or deflates, it doesn't matter. The woman is always going to get that amount which was appraised at the time of the ksuva. So, nechsetzon barzel is owned by the husband, but at the same time, he has meshubad to pay that amount to his wife upon death or divorce. So the Gemara says, these three properties, if the husband makes an attempt to sell any of these three properties, the sale is going to be immediately negated by virtue of the fact that the woman was looking forward to these properties as compensation in the event of death or divorce. So the Gemara says, fine, I kind of understand this point, but the Gemara says, but let's analyze this even a little bit better. Lumute mai. Meaning, and this excludes what? So the Gemara says, now what about any of his other properties? So any of his other properties which are mortgaged against the ksuva, so the Gemara says, now if he sells it, and then he turns to his wife and says, hey, you're okay if I sell this, right? And her response is, sure, I'd love it if you sold it. That wouldn't make me any happier. So again, the Gemara says, obviously, she only said that in order to prevent Ava, in order to prevent animosity between him and her. And you can't assume that her yes is a genuine yes. And the Gemara says, under those circumstances, clearly, the sale is going to be blocked. Now, let me just make a point over here about the sale being blocked. What I'm saying is not 100% accurate. It's not that the sale is going to be blocked. Meaning, if a husband wants to sell his property, it's his property. Of course he can sell it. The Rashbam points out on the bottom of the previous Amud, and the top over here of this Amud as well, the Rashbam points out, it's not that the sale is going to be blocked. In other words, a husband has every right to sell his property. It's just that her lien is still going to be existent. And that in the event of death or divorce, she will always have a lien to exercise. And there's never going to be a situation where the husband, where the buyer is going to say, oh, wait a second. We had a conversation prior to the sale. And we asked her, are you ready to forgive the lien? And she said, yes, I'm ready to forgive the lien. She only said that in order to appease her husband. But she didn't mean it. But we're not really saying, like I said a moment ago, I'm just clarifying. We're not really saying that the sale is going to be blocked. It just simply means that her lien is still going to be in existence, and that in the event that she can exercise a lien, she can, and there is no waiver of her lien, even if she says there's a waiver of her lien. That's really what the Gemara's point is over here. Back to the Gemara, third line down. And as far as the argument is concerned, look, here's how the conversation is going. I want to sell my property. This is a husband. I want to sell my property. You're okay with that, right? So she says, if she were to say, no, I'm not okay with that, isn't that supposed to go for my ksuva? Okay, that's her line. His line now is, well, are we talking about divorce? Are we talking about death? Meaning, why are you having these kinds of morbid discussions at this point in time? Meaning, I'm going to be here forever. You're going to be forever. The marriage is going to be forever. Like, why are you talking like that? And then, obviously, back and forth, and then it will turn into a debate, and that's all no good. So she basically, smart woman that she is, she cuts the whole thing off by simply saying, sure, whatever you want. But again, the Gemara understands that sure, whatever you want, meaning go ahead, sell the property. But sure, whatever you want is not really her acquiescing. It's just simply she doesn't want to get into that debate. And so therefore, she is agreeing, but not really agreeing. And the Gemara says, and we know that. And we understand that. So with all that in play now, so the Gemara says, so I don't understand. We are saying that her yes, when she's asked the question, do you want to sell, are you ready to waive your lien to the property? And she says yes. So we're talking about the three specific properties that were earmarked towards the ksuva that the Gemara says is a given. The Gemara says, what about all other properties that he sells? And she has a lien on all other properties. The Gemara says, even there, it's a given. Her yes is not really a yes. So the Gemara says, so now I'm just wondering. So now we're saying that there's an exclusion where sometimes your yes is meant to be taken literally. When would that be? Right now, it's not the three properties. And quite frankly, it's not any of his properties that he sells that's mortgage against the ksuva. In every one of those occasions, when she's asked the question, are you also ready to sell your lien against the property? And she says, yes, we don't understand her yes to be yes. So with all that stated, what are we talking about? So the Gemara says, I'll tell you what we're talking about. We're talking about her nechze malug. Now, nechze malug, unlike the nechze tzon barza, which is written to the ksuva and is really fundamentally his, nechze malug or any properties that she does not write into the ksuva, which are fundamentally hers. They are her properties. However, as we've learned time and again, in the course of the marriage, after the nisuin, after the second stage of marriage, the husband is entitled to the peros, to the yield of all those properties. So, in title, it's her name. In usage, it's his. So the Gemara says, and what the Gemara now is arguing is that, well, if she's asked, are you ready to sell your nechze malug? And she says yes, the Gemara right now thinks, well, her yes is not really, I'm sorry, now the Gemara thinks her yes is actually understood to mean yes. And again, if we think about it, it makes sense. It is her property. So the Gemara says, V'ha'amar meimah, the Gemara says, but let's consider what a meimah taught us, which is, Ishvisha shemachu b'nechze malug, lo'as v'lo klum. So the Gemara says, now we have a comment by a meimah, not a comment, but a statement by a meimah that says that if a husband and wife are asked the question, are the two of you ready to sell the nechze malug? Now again, each one has a ownership side to it. The wife, she has title. The husband, he has usage. So they both have aspects of the land. So I'm going to both of them. And I'm saying, listen, the two of you, woman, wife, are you ready to sell your title? Husband, are you ready to sell your usage? And they both agree, and a mamer says the sale's not going to be a valid sale. Well, why not? Meaning the only thing, the only time that we don't assume that the wife is genuine is in order to prevent fighting, and that's when the husband is selling his properties which are mortgaged against the ksuva. And she didn't say anything because she doesn't want a fight to ensue. But over here, Nechse Malog, which is her property, and she's saying yes, so why shouldn't the sale be a good sale? So the Gemara says like this. So the Gemara says, okay. Well, we don't fully understand a Memar we're about to right now. So the Gemara says, well, let's say he's the one who sold the Nechse Malog property. Now again, what is he selling? It's not his. What he's selling is Peros. In other words, he has Peros, and so it is usage, it's yield, and that's what he sells. So the Gemara says, fine. So he sells it, but he can only sell it while he's alive. The moment that he dies, she goes back and she says, okay, thank you very much. I'll take back my usage. My husband sold it, but my husband only had rights to it while he was alive. Once he's no longer alive, so it comes back to me. Inam izavna iu mesa, or let's say, for example, she sells her title to the property, and then she dies. Now, one can easily imagine, before we read the next lines of the Gemara, well, if she sells her title, and then she dies, so who's the title holder? The buyer. Meaning he bought the title. It's her property, it's her title to sell. So it's interesting where we're saying that right now that if she sells title and she dies, so then it goes to the husband. Why should that be? So the Gemara says that's because of a takana, which we've heard already a number of times throughout Shas, and we're going to hear it again today. That's a takana that the husband gets the nechse malug. This was instituted in Usha, which is a isha shemachar benechse malug umesa, that when a woman sells a nechse malug, which again, without the takana, she's certainly able to do so. It's her property. She's a title owner. Therefore, she could sell it. But in Usha, they instituted that a woman who sells a nechse malug and then she dies, haba motzi mi'ad lekuchos, the husband takes away from the buyer. How is the husband treated vis-a-vis the nechse malug? He's considered lokeach number one, even though he didn't actually buy it, but the takana assigns him to be buyer number one. So since he's buyer number one, so therefore he takes away from buyer number two. But the Gemara says, fine. In those cases, the sale is not going to be a valid sale. But if the two of them are asked, do you want to sell the nechse malug? And he agrees and she agrees. So then the sale is going to be a good sale. Or let's say she sells the nechse malug to her husband. That sale is going to be a good sale. And over there, again, we're not worried about she's just giving
how can she sell something he's entitled to?
He's only entitled to the peros. She's selling him the title. She's the owner of the title. It's nechse malug. So the Gemara says, so if she sells it to him, so then the sale is going to be a valid sale. So all this now is suggestion number one of how to understand a Mamer. So now basically everything works so far in the Gemara. Meaning that when a husband sells off his own properties, woman is asked, are you ready to give up your lien? And she says yes, or yes is not to be understood as yes. I say yes just simply so that me and my husband do not fight. That's the only reason why I said yes, and that argument stands up in a court of law, court of Jewish law, halacha. So that is a valid argument, and as a result of that, she did not give up her lien. She did not sell the lien. She did not waive the lien. I guess you can ask me the question: what if she actually received money? I assume the money is going to be returned. I'm not sure. Okay, but either way, her yes is not to be understood as yes. And what about things that can be sold? So the answer is nechse malug. When can nechse malug be sold? Because remember, in the marriage, nechse malug is divided. She has title, he has usage. So if I go to both of them and I say, are you ready to share each one of your shares of the nechse malug? And they both agree, so then the sale is valid. Or, the Gemara says, if the wife sells her nechse malug to her husband, he already has the usage and now he's buying the title, the Gemara says that's also valid as well. The Gemara says, or what we could do is we can give another pshat in a Meimar. So far we've given one. The Gemara says we can give a second pshat. And which is a Meimar d'Amar k'Rabbi Elazar. That we could put a Meimar together with the opinion of Rabbi Elazar the Tana. A Meimer is an Amora, Rebbe Elazar is a Tana. The Gemara says, but if we make the assumption that a Meimer is going like Rebbe Elazar, that's another way to understand a Meimer on the simplest level, which is that a Meimer said that even if I went to the husband and I went to the wife and I bought the Nechse Malug, the sale's not going to be a valid sale. How can that be? So we have to learn together this Brisa. It's a little bit long, you know, in Baba Basra terms. It's a little bit long. Once we get through the Brisa and once we see the opinion of Rabbi Lazar, then we'll understand the opinion of Amemar. Titania, the Brisa deals with the following scenario. So first and foremost, let's reacquaint ourselves with a halacha, and that is that if a person kills another person, so that's a capital crime that comes along with it, capital punishment. If a person kills an Eved Kenani, so here, if the owner kills an Eved Kenani, so if the death is instantaneous, that's murder, and that's a capital crime coming with a capital punishment. If, however, the death is a delayed death. Now, let me just back up for a moment. If a person kills another person, Jew kills another Jew, so even on a delayed death, that's a capital crime with a capital punishment. Okay, that Gemara says that's straightforward. And the delay could be a day, could be a week, could be a year. As long as we know verifiably that the death came as a result of the blow that happened a year ago, so that's capital punishment. The death does not have to happen immediately. When a master hits his slave, if the death occurs instantaneously or at least within 24 hours from the hit, so then that's a capital crime that's coming along with the capital punishment. If, however, the death is delayed, now the Torah says, oh, yomo yamayim, either one day or 2 days, but we know that really means 24 hours. If the death is delayed for more than 24 hours, so that does not have capital punishment. It's still obviously wrong, and we're not excusing the behavior, but just simply a patur from Mises Beis Din. And you're not going to get a capital crime.
The first case is not a grama case if it lasts for so long. It's grama.
No, it's not grama because you actually hit him. Grama means when I indirectly cause the death. Meaning I did something, but what I did is not actually cause the death. I tied a person up in front of a waterfall. Okay. The water caused the death. I just simply put him in the situation where he couldn't get out of. Over here, I actually hit him. That's biyadayim. It's just that the effect didn't take place immediately, but still, I did a biyadayim. Therefore, that is me. That's me killing. Therefore, that's a capital punishment. Okay. So when you hit your eved, and he doesn't die within the first 24 hours, so there's a patur. There's going to be an exemption from the death penalty. Okay. That's the basic halacha. And now we go into the Brisa, where Brisa discusses the following scenario. Hamocher zavdo pasuk imoshim shiyishmashenu shloshim yom. So here's what I did. I sold my Eved Kenani. Now again, Eved Kenani is a sellable item, sellable person. But I sold my Eved Kenani. But I said to the buyer, look, here's what I like to do. I'm selling you the Eved right now. So in other words, if we're going to treat the Eved like karka, I'm basically saying you're the title holder as of this moment. However, what I'd like to do is I'd like to retain my usage of the Eved Kenani at least for the next 30 days. Okay, I got to finish my job here in the field. I need him for the next 30 days. So you'll assume title immediately, and I want to retain usage for myself. So basically now, if you can imagine, we're basically doing Nechse Maluk. We are breaking up title and usage. One person has title, the other person has usage. The cases are not exactly the same. We'll turn our attention to that distinction a little bit later. The truth of the matter is, the Gemara is not going to be bothered by the minor distinctions that separate these two cases. It's basically the same. We're breaking up title and usage. So now we want to know the following: for the next 30 days, where the buyer has the title, the original owner has retained usage for himself, and now the original owner beats his Evan. And he dies, but not within the first 24 hours. So is he considered the owner vis-a-vis he's going to now enjoy? I use the word enjoy over here in a very limited sense. Don't quote me out of context. Will he be able to enjoy the patur of Yom HaYamayim? So is he considered the owner vis-a-vis the patur? So, Rabbi Meir Omer Arishon Yeshno Bedin Yom HaYamayim Mimneshu Tachtav Vashini Eina Bedin Yom HaYamayim Mimneshu Eino Tachtav. So Rabbi Meir has the following opinion. The original owner has now retained the peros, the usage of the Eved Kenani. So as far as he's concerned, he gets the halach of Yom HaYomayim. The buyer, the holder of the title, who does not have the services of the Eved for the next 30 days, he doesn't have the patur of Yom HaYomayim. Why? The Gemara goes on to explain. This is now the Gemara commenting on the Braisa. Kasavra Kinyan Peres Kikinyan Aguf Dami. Because the Reb Meir is of the opinion that Kinyan Peres is Kikinyan Aguf, that because he has retained usage for himself, so the usage of himself is tantamount to Kinyan Aguf, and therefore he is considered the default owner, and therefore he enjoys the patur of Yom HaYomayim. Okay. Just as an interesting comment over here on the Gemara, if you think about it, if Kinyan Aperis is Kinyan Aguf, what do you think Kinyan Aguf is? Meaning, the person who bought the title. So if the person who retains usage gets the patur of Yom HaYomayim because he is the owner of the peros, shouldn't the second person who actually owns the guf ha'eved, shouldn't he also have the patur as well? Okay, I put that out there. That's a lot of food for thought. But anyway, Shitas Rav Meir is that the one who has the peros, he's the one who enjoys the patur of Yom HaYomayim. Rav Yehuda Omer Hashem Yeshna Bedin Yom HaYomayim Imeshu Kaspo. And Rav Yehuda says, no, it's the second one who's the title holder. He is the one who owns the Eved, and therefore he has the patur of Yom HaYomayim, but not the original owner who right now only has the peros. Harishon Eino Bedin Yom HaYomayim Sheino Kaspo. The first one who does not have the owner of the title of the Eved, therefore he's not considered the owner vis-a-vis the patur of Yom HaYomayim. Kasavra Kinyan Peros Lavka Kinyan Aguf Dami. So the Gemara says, now this also is really easy to explain. Rav Yehuda is of the opinion that Kinyan Peros is a Lav Kinyan Aguf. It's not tantamount to ownership of title, and therefore the original owner who only has Peros right now does not get the benefit of the patur of Yom HaYomayim. Rav Yossi Omar Shneim. Top of Nun Amud Beis. Shneim Yeshem Bedin Yom HaYomayim. Zeb Ibn Neshu Tachtav, Zeb Ibn Neshu Kaspo. And Rabbi Shimon is of the opinion that they both have the Ptur of Yom HaYomayim. The original owner for the next 30 days has retained usage. The person who bought the title effective immediately. So both of them, if they were to kill the Eved, and he doesn't die immediately, and he only dies after 24 hours, both of them will have that Ptur, and neither of them will be put to death. Why? So the Gemara goes on to explain. Umisafka lay e kinyan peres ki kinyan aguf e lav ki kinyan aguf dami. As far as Rabbi Shimon is concerned, well, on this issue of whether or not kinyan peres is like kinyan aguf, yes or no? So his position is, I simply don't know. I have a suffix. And now, again, I'm making a point which is obvious. The Gemara is not condoning the action of the owner, meaning the owner should not have hit the Eved. The owner should certainly not have hit the Eved to the point where he died. But now it's a question of killing the owner. So now, what do we say, generally speaking, when it comes to taking a life? Even somebody who did something which was wrong. We say, v'hitzilu esa'ida, that whenever we have somebody's life at stake, and Basin has to make a decision, should we execute or should we not execute? Beis Din has a mandate of, well, if the law is kill him, but do everything within your legal power to save him from being killed. That's the mandate of the Tzilo Saida. So over here, since we're not sure which one of the two, the original owner, or the one who bought him, has the patur of Yom HaYomayim, and since Rabbi Shimon's saying, I have a suffix as to whether or not Kinyan Aperis is Kikinyan Aguf or Lav Kikinyan Aguf, therefore, I'm not going to kill either. Neither the original owner, nor the one who bought him. And we're always going to be lenient when it comes to Basin having to put somebody to death. And then finally, so what do we have right now in terms of our options? Meaning, I should have said this in the very beginning. All right, how many possibilities are there in terms of who gets the patur? So the answer is the original owner. That's A. B, the one who bought him. C, both. And of course, there's a D option as well. And that's going to be neither, which is the Shita of Rebbe Elazar, which we're going to see together right now. Rebbe Elazar Omer Shneim Eina Bedin Yom HaYomayim Ze Lefi Sheino Tachtav Veze Lefi Sheino Kaspo. So, Rebbe Elazar, which is the fourth Shita over here, says that neither. Meaning, once we take Guf and Peros. And once we divide them, so then who is the owner? So Rabbi Lazar will tell you, nobody's the owner. Meaning an owner can only be defined by a person who has both Peros and Guf. One who has Peros is not a full owner and therefore not an owner. One who has Guf is not a full owner and therefore not an owner. Therefore, Rav Elazar says, if either one of them were to hit the Eved and he dies, and regardless of how long it took for him to die, since neither of them are the owner, therefore neither of them have the Ptur of Yom O Yomayim. The Amarava, my time in the Rabbi Lazar Amarkar, lo yakum ki kaspo hu. Kaspo miyuchad lo. In order to define kesef, meaning ownership, ownership is defined when you have both. When you have one of the two, so then that is not considered enough of an ownership, and therefore you don't get the patur of Yom Yomayim. And here's where the Gemara now, the Gemara doesn't finish a sentence, but here obviously is how the Gemara is now going to have to finish a sentence. We're looking for a pshat and a meimer. A meimer says that when I go to a husband and wife, and I want to buy the nechse maluk, and I say to the husband, you ready to sell your peros? He says yes. And I say to the wife, and you're ready to sell your guf? And she says yes. And I buy it from a joint, in other words, between the two of them, I'm buying now the land. A meimer says the sale is not going to be a good sale.
Either one.
So we originally assume before we get to this whole brisa that if they sell together, then of course. In other words, they complement one another in terms of what each one owns. And so therefore I buy the whole thing. What the Gemara now is saying is a new pshat in a meimer, which is I bought nothing. Why did I buy nothing? Because there's no owner. Because even though the husband says, yes, I'm ready to sell, he's not the owner. He only has payers. And when I go to the wife and I say, and I'm ready to buy from you, are you ready to sell? She says, yes. Well, she's not the owner because she only has title. She doesn't have payers. And what the Gemara is doing now is so interesting. The Gemara is saying is that if you are not holding both payers and goof, you are simply not the owner. And I can't even put the two together. If the two are owned by two different people, I can't even put the two together in order to create an ownership group in order to sell. It simply does not work. Neither are the true owner. Now,
what about partnership and how do they sell?
Right, so you have to say that by a partnership. When I own 50%, I own 50% of both. I own 50% of Paris and I own 50% of Guff. Over here, of course.
How does the partnership sell? Each one sells half.
Right.
His whole half.
Right.
Whole.
But when I'm separating Peros and Guf, neither is considered an owner. Okay, again, all this is only according to Rabbi Lazar, right? The Gemara doesn't subscribe, meaning the Halacha doesn't subscribe to it. But if you assume like Rabbi Lazar, so then, yes, and now we have said a new pshat in a Meimar. And it's certainly a very interesting one. Okay, let's start the next Gemara. Velo Ish. Chazaka b'nechse ishto. A husband cannot create a chazaka in his wife's property. We went the other way, meaning the previous case in the that we saw, we said back in the Mishnah. This Mishnah takes us back some time now. The Mishnah we saw going all the way back to. Wow. I don't know. Right, wow. The Mishnah takes us all the way back to Membeis. Wow. Okay, so we are almost 10 days later. So the Mishnah says that a wife cannot create a chazaka in her husband's property, and a husband cannot create a cheskes gimel shanim in his wife's property. The Gemara now describes how a husband cannot create a chazaka in his wife's property. V'amar Rav Sheshes Ish Tricha Limchos. So the Gemara says, now, the husband needs to protest. Now, the Gemara says, Beman. The Gemara says, now, wait, what does that mean, the husband needs to protest? The wife has to make a protest. The Gemara says, Beman. The Gemara says, now, who is she protesting from? Who is occupying her property that she needs to protest? So the Gemara says, Elam Abachir, if we're talking about somebody else, meaning not her husband, but an outsider, the Gemara says, she doesn't need to make a protest. So the Gemara says that we have a general rule that nobody can assume occupancy / ownership of a wife's property. So, and the reason why we'll assume that is because the husband is always going to be defensive of his wife's property. The Rashbam writes, Because a wife always has the right to say, "Al bali samachti." In other words, I got married, and who's taking care of my property? My husband's taking care of my property. So now, responsibility of the property shifts over to the husband. So therefore, the wife can always say, "Well, I was counting on my husband to make a macha." And therefore, we can excuse the fact that she didn't protest because she has a very legitimate excuse. Elalav biba. So the Gemara says, well, so what it must mean, therefore, is that she has to protest against occupancy from her husband. So the Gemara says, oh, I'm sorry, that's presumably what Rav meant. Now, if that's what Rav meant, how does that work with our Mishnah? Because our Mishnah says that a husband cannot create a cheskes gemel shanim on his wife's property, and meanwhile, Rav's saying that she has to protest. So Amar Rav Lolam Baba'al Kigon Shechafar Ba'bar Shechon Amaros. So the Gemara says, well, no, it's the husband. And you know what the husband's doing right now with her property? He's making a mess out of her property. He's digging holes, and he's digging ditches, and he's going crazy. And now, let's say, under normal circumstances, she doesn't protest. Okay, under normal circumstances, she doesn't protest because why does she need to? In other words, it's simply the relationship of husband and wife, and of course he's going to be on my property. And of course I don't need to say anything because he's not going to become the owner. But if he's ruining the property and I say nothing, so the Gemara says, so that would be an indication of ownership. And therefore, by her not saying anything, that in fact will cede the land over to the husband. So the Gemara says, so the Gemara says, what about a statement that was made in the name of Rava Baravua, which is that there's no chazaka when it comes to Nezek. So the Gemara says, Eima ein din chazaka l'nizakin. So the Gemara says, well, first of all, you know what that can mean? It can mean that, generally speaking, how do you occupy slash end up owning a field by being there in 3 years? But if you're doing damage to somebody's property and he doesn't say anything, so you know what that effectively does? It creates immediate ownership. The Gemara says that's one way to understand the statement. Ibai Samo, the Gemara says, oh, you know, there's another way to understand the statement, which takes us back to what we learned earlier in the Masechta. It has nothing to do with ownership. It has to do with rights and usages, which is, Lav Itmar La, didn't we say this back earlier in the Masechta? Rav Mari Amar Bekutra Rav Zid Amar Bebeis Akise. Let's say that out of my property, remember we had this lengthy discussion back in the second parak of Baba Basra, right? In other words, I have my property. What can I do on my property? Essentially anything I want. And even if it's kind of noxious to you, in other words, I could do what I want on my property. That's the Shita Rav Yossi. And you want to keep your distance. That's your responsibility to keep your distance away from my property. However, if it's a kind of usage which is really obnoxious and noxious, meaning like bathroom usage or like very thick smoke. So if it comes out of my property, I can't say to you, you know, I've had a bathroom here for many years and you seem to be okay with it. Even though, again, it's bathrooms on my property and your property is obviously your property. But you never complained about it. So what we said back in the second parak of Baba Basra was that you cannot create a chazakah of usage for something that's so noxious, like bathroom and like thick smoke. And so therefore the neighbor can say, look, I know I've tolerated for this many years, but you know what? You got to take your bathroom and you got to move it back into your property. I don't have to tolerate it, and I can tell you to move it. So the Gemara says that could be another pshat altogether of what we mean when we say in chazak l'nizakin, having nothing to do with our discussion over here. Okay, so again, let's just quickly wrap it up in terms of today's daf. We started off the discussion today regarding a wife's selling of her lien of her husband's property, and generally our assumption is that even when she says, yes, I'm ready to sell the lien on my husband's property, her yes never is intended to be yes, but rather she just simply didn't want to get into a fight with her husband. So she just smiled and said yes, but the truth of the matter is that although the husband has every right to sell his property, the lien that she has on the property is going to always stand, and it always is going to be collectible in the event of death or divorce, and her yes is not to be understood as a yes. Okay, why this should be different than Teluya Bezavin, so that's difficult to explain. And the Rashbam has a pshat. I said over the Rashbam, I need to understand it better myself.
The husband and wife, they never can sell?
No, the husband can sell his property, But the wife is always going to have a lien on that property because of the ksuva.
But if they want to sell, if she wants to sell.
We always assume that even when she agrees to sell, it's only because she wants to make her husband happy.
There's no way of buying because it's the land.
There's no way of buying the lien. You buy the land, but there's no way of buying the lien. She has a lien on the property.
And she has a lien, never bought it?
No, of course you buy it. In other words, but in the event that, in other words, first of all, the lien may never be exercised. If she dies before he does, then the lien goes away. But the Gemara's assumption is that no, she never gives up on the lien. If it's nechzei malug, which means that it's her property, and you go to her and you ask her to sell the property, and you go to the husband and you ask him, can I buy your usage? Yes. So the Gemara says you can do that. Now a Maimer made a comment that says that you can't do that. So we did one of two things with a Maimer. Either we qualified a Maimer statement, which is that we only went to one of the two, we didn't go to both. Or the Gemara says that we can qualify, we don't have to qualify a Maimer statement, but we could just simply line up a Maimer like the sheet of Rav Elazar, that when you split Peiros and Guf, neither is considered the true owner, and therefore neither has the right to sell. And even through the joint effort of the two, you don't have the right to sell. That's a Beit Chiddush, but the Gemara says that's another way to understand a Maimer. And finally, we talked about a husband sitting on his wife's property, creating a cheskes kemoshanim. The Mishnah says it simply does not happen. It does not work. The Gemara says makes a comment by Rav that the wife never needs to protest her husband's occupancy of the land. So the Gemara says that's generally speaking true. If an outsider sits on the land, for sure she doesn't need to protest. Even if the husband herself is sitting on the land, she doesn't need to protest. But under limited circumstances, she needs to make a protest. For example, if he's destroying the land and she sits there and she's quiet and she doesn't protest. Under those circumstances, so then it was expected for her to make a protest. She didn't. So then the husband can assume occupancy/ ownership. Otherwise, she doesn't need to protest.